This is the
Antioch Worship Leadership Podcast.
A podcast about worshiping diversely together.
Have mercy.
Let me say it one more time. Antioch Worship Leadership Podcast.
A podcast ministry of Madison Church.
Oh, I got
Welcome to episode 23 of the Antioch Worship Leadership Podcast. My name is Eric, producer of the Antioch Podcast, and I would like to introduce you to today's guest, Pastor Reggie Smith. Pastor Reggie is the director of the Offices of Race Relations and Social Justice for the Christian Reformed Church in North America. He advises churches and organizations on cross-cultural and urban ministry. He has written extensively through devotionals, articles, book reviews, and web articles as a senior pastor over the past 20 years. He has spoken widely as a guest preacher, seminary professor, and workshop leader. He also serves as a program affiliate with the Calvin Institute of Christian Worship in the areas of faith, work, and worship, universal design for worship, urban ministry, and justice issues. I had the opportunity to meet with Pastor Reggie in his office at the headquarters of the Christian Reformed Church of North America to talk with him about a recent article he published in the Grand Rapids Times entitled, "Dear White West Michigan People, West Michigan Nice is Not Working." Let's go now and listen to the interview. So, Pastor Reggie, I read something that you put on Facebook just a couple weeks ago. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I knew right away, as soon as I read it, that this was a conversation that I was dying to have. Because I think you said some things that were worded in a very succinct way that I think is incredibly applicable, not just in society, but especially in multi-ethnic churches. Who was the original publication for your article?
The Grand Rapids Times.
Okay, so for people that aren't from Grand Rapids, that don't know, what is the Grand Rapids Times?
Grand Rapids Times is the African-American newspaper that's been around since the 1950s, and I've been privileged to write as a religion columnist for the last 7 years. And I consider it like one of my highlights because for me, being part of a white denomination, this is the first time that I get to preach to black people on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
And this is just feels like a good space in which I can be myself.
Yeah.
And yeah. I really enjoy that.
Yeah, kind of a breath of fresh air.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And honestly, I think it would be a really good interview to also talk about what are the things that you need to do as a person of color in a mostly white space to have good self-care. Mm-hmm. I think that would be fascinating because I think some folks don't think about that as often as maybe is important to.
Yeah, that's one of the areas that we very rarely talk about is that when we're engaging in this kind of work of racial journey and conciliation, our souls are the ones that dry up, and they dry up quickly, and we don't have places or spaces in which we can have that refilled. Just like any empty container, we have to have those places in which we are filled up as we are doing this work, because this work will drain you. It will take out the best of you, mm-hmm. and you need it.
And you used a term there, racial conciliation, mm-hmm. and I know you've used that on purpose, or I'm guessing, because mm-hmm. you're smiling when I'm bringing this up here. Let's take a sidestep here and talk about what are some of the discussions right now in kind of, I'll say, the racial reconciliation community about language and describing what the work, in quotes, what that means. Because you said racial conciliation.
Mm-hmm.
That's a on purpose choice of words.
That is on purpose.
Yeah. So can you define a little bit, what's the difference between racial conciliation and racial reconciliation, which has kind of been a buzzword since the 90s?
I actually have been familiar with Mark Charles. And Mark Charles has really given some really careful thought about, you can't really reconcile when it's been crappy from day one, and as if that is a clean slate. And so conciliation means that you have to work from a place of looking at history and then working back. Mm-hmm. You cannot assume that there is this blank space or this blank that nothing happened. Everything's good. Let's just go about it, come back together. And that hasn't happened. We're assuming that, you know, just like the Civil War ended in 1865, did it really end? Or did it just continue in another form?
Yep.
And we know by history that's actually what happened, whether that was Reconstruction, Jim Crow, civil rights. And conciliation is at least a more honest word of saying that there is still work we got to do. Mm-hmm. And that work didn't just start today. It started way back. And that's the place that we need to begin. And I think that helps us to kind of go beyond kind of a Pollyannish, oh, let's just get together and be brothers and sisters and act as if nothing happened for the last 200 years. Mm-hmm. And just think that if our churches are multicultural, if our churches are multiracial, then everything's fine, right?
So, in other words, if I as a white person just don't use the N-word, that alone doesn't make me okay?
That is right. It just not mentioning the N-word is more than that.
Okay, what about if I also like go to a multi-ethnic church, does that make me like a little better?
Nope. It doesn't make you a little better. But I think it makes it difficult to ask that harder question. Mm-hmm. Why am I doing this?
Yeah.
Am I doing this for the right reasons? Mm-hmm. And hopefully that it helps you to expose our own way of saying that our own niceness becomes a spiritual virtue.
Yeah.
And really it isn't. It's just another way of hiding our own sin.
Yeah. I know that for me, in my own journey, like there are times where I really, really long for the good white guy merit badge, which I heard an interview a few weeks ago where this guy said, like, well, when was whiteness good? And that's a good question too.
Mm-hmm.
So when whiteness and blackness is as categories were set up with a dominance system,
mm-hmm.
implied,
right.
Kind of like, oh, language matters.
Language matters. It matters a great deal in how we use it and how we define it. Because let's be clear that definitions and words matter. And it matters in law, it matters in policy, it matters in religion. Mm-hmm. And if we think that those words don't matter, all you got to do is pick up any history book and it'll tell you exactly what matters.
Yeah. How would you compare or contrast racial conciliation with anti-racism?
Yeah. Anti-racism is to take an intentional group of people who are bringing under a microscope everything in which they do as an institution. It means the decisions that they made. It means the history that they have. It means the policies in which they enacted. It means the interaction that they have on the outside. It means what's the culture on the inside. It is taking all of those things and saying that from one point we operated in a racist way. It is not meant to demean. It is not meant to be angry at people. It is saying that from a power point of view, we've operated and imposed ourselves on people, and we don't even know it. And now we're saying that we're going to take an intentional look at, now how do we make all of our policies and institutional and root out institutional racism mm-hmm. from all aspects in all facets of our life as a church.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've heard some people actually describe the work as some people say, like, okay, my part of the work is racial reconciliation. Mm-hmm. Other people say my part of the work is anti-racism. Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting discussion to see how this is going to play out over the next few years. Mm-hmm. But you wrote something that, would you say that this falls in one camp or another camp in terms of those kind of language clusters of what the work is?
Yeah, I hope that my little essay would be something in the middle, which would create intentionally mm-hmm. tension in the sense of that we don't know how to live in the midst of tension. In fact, we try to run away from it. We either try to alleviate it because it creates anxiety for us, or we try to run away from it because we don't want anything to do with it, and we have to maintain this control of niceness that we think has been sanctified by the Lord. And I think that same thing happens in churches, especially churches that are multicultural, multiracial. It is that we work so hard to diffuse tension that we don't see tension as a way of creating space or capacity or a new way of seeing what is God up to mm-hmm. in dealing with these people at this particular time and helping them to be a witness and a model that other people can say, it looks like these people actually love each other and mm-hmm. they show their stuff, their actual lives to each other. Mm-hmm. And I think those are the places in which you can't do unless there is some absolute tension that enters into the room. That's what I hope my article did, and it seemed to kind of touch the nerve with a few people.
That we have in common is that we both have cross-cultural interracial mm-hmm. marriages. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those are their own dynamics, but it also gives you access to seeing people in a family setting mm-hmm. that maybe you wouldn't in another case. So, and that's in some ways the setting, isn't it, for your article?
Right, right, right. It's an incident that happened last Thanksgiving and, in which, I heard it was an election that happened.
I heard that as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, and it kind of happened. And you know, after that election, my in-laws said that we don't want to come to Thanksgiving talking about politics, and so no politics at this Thanksgiving. Okay. So we went. We had turkey and food, and it was a wonderful time, and... But everybody knew there was a pink elephant in the room. I don't know if it was pink or blue or mm-hmm. or green, but he was there. And I just came away with, wow, what happened? And started to kind of think about that and look at that in the light of Charlottesville. And as I was looking at it through this portal, I thought, wow, maybe this is what I have experienced in West Michigan, mm-hmm. and in West Michigan, we pride ourselves on niceness, and maybe that's an American affliction, in that we don't ever want to be accused as not being nice, mm-hmm. we don't ever want to be accused as not being a good person, and so we carry around this facade that if we're just nice to people, then there has to be some redeeming value in that. What really happens is that we set up this false picture that all of life is good, and as long as we don't talk about it, then we should be okay.
Right.
And people of color should be okay with that as well. Well, I wanted to kind of puncture the balloon of that of that that theory that niceness will accomplish a lot in terms of race relations. And in actuality, what it accomplishes is absolutely more lying. It's like the secret that nobody wants to know, or you know, maybe a scene out of the you know, M. Night Shyamalan, you know, movie. There are no dead people here, but everybody knows there are. They're right there, and yet we act as if things in our communities and in our neighborhoods are doing just quite well, as if we can kind of manage the racial tension, the racial animosity that is rising, and especially in light of, as I was writing towards Charlottesville, that I thought that the president made a direct turn that I had never seen from any other elected official when he was citing and saying that neo-Nazis and KKK and all these kind of hate groups were fine people, and that there was blame on many sides. And I thought that he crossed the line and said, okay, I think he's racist in chief. And I had to make a decision. Would I continue to recapitulate of what I had seen for 30 years and not say a word? And I said, well, I can't. I have to name this disease that is happening here in West Michigan. This disease is not going to get any better by us doing the placebo of niceness. Mm-hmm. We have to expose it. It has to be put out there. And so that was one of the things in which I said, I got to write. I got to write it. I was unaware of the amount of energy, both positive and negative, that came from writing this article. But it did get us to start having these hard conversations, and, you know, some of that even started at home.
Yeah. Would you mind reading this article? Because I want people to hear it. I think hearing it in your voice, especially since you wrote it, I think there's something kind of additionally beautiful when you get to hear an author read their own work.
Sure. Last Thanksgiving, my family prepared to go to dinner with my wife's extended family in Ottawa County. The tumultuous presidential election that ushered Donald Trump into the White House lingered in my family like an after New Year's Eve hangover. My father-in-law sent word to us that no political talk was allowed at our house. He knew that there was a deep divide between my family and my wife's family members. After the call, my wife and I stared at each other with shock. We swallowed our pride for the sake of unity and attended the dinner. My daughter blurted out only one Trump put down, but we ate and we played and watched sports as if the world had not changed on November 4, 2016. We played West Michigan nice for the sake of family. Like Rodney King's mantra after the 1996 Los Angeles riots, can't we just all get along? Peace is more important than tough conversation. Fast forward 8 months. President Donald Trump stood in the lobby of his Golden Manhattan building to give his true assessments of the Charlottesville, Virginia white nationalist march during which a protester, Heather Hare, was killed. His first crack at being a healer in chief didn't go well. Others criticized him for his lukewarm rebuke of neo-Nazis, Ku Klux Klan, and white nationalists. He explained both sides were wrong. Are you kidding me? Next, President Trump gave a second try at advice from his advisors. The Donald was not feeling it. In New York, he had to be himself. He had to be back on his home turf with the bright lights. The president gave one of the most revealing press conferences I had ever seen from an occupant of the White House. What did the president reveal? Trump called racist protesters in Charlottesville fine people. He berated to the reporters that the anti-protesters were at fault too. According to the August 17 SurveyMonkey poll, which asked who was responsible for the turmoil, 81% of Republicans agreed with Trump. They were not leaving the racist in chief. I concluded Trump made the choice. He decided to stand with racists. It was clear to me where the president stood on race relations in the age of Trump. But what does this mean for us in West Michigan? Conversations about race in our neck of the woods is difficult because whites choose West Michigan nice as their default approach. Why do my dear white people disdain conflict? Why do my dear white people remain silent? Why do my dear white people settle for anxious status quo, then unearth the hard-nosed issues of racial segregation in our schools, churches, and neighborhood? West Michigan nice is evil, and it must not have its way with us. Author Todd Robinson, in his book, City Within the City, argued, West Michigan leaders manage racism through gradual bite-sized progress. Yet according to Forbes, Grand Rapids is the second worst place to live for African Americans. Being nice to each other hides our complicity. West Michigan nice is not working. Let's try hard conversations of patient truth-telling, courage, sacrifice, along with action that makes a difference. My dear white people, it is your move.
Yeah, that was really good. So you wrote that 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago.
What'd you hear back?
Oh, I heard a lot back. I took a picture of the article and I put it on Facebook. I got comments from, why are you doing this to your family? You shouldn't do things like this. Don't you care about them? This is unfair to them. I got comments that this is just a farce. This is part of the left trying to shame the right and other Trump voters. I got positive from Brave to, wow, I'm glad you said it.
Oh, you emphasized you?
I'm glad you said it. I assume that they didn't want to get shot at. So yeah, better you than me. But, you know, I have received more positive than the negative. But it was interesting that on my Facebook page, it created this conversation that I was just talking about in the article, that people were beginning to have the hard kind of conversation. Now, was most of that conversation helpful? Nah, it depends. Some of it was, some of it not so helpful. But I think that at least it got people to thinking. I knew this was what was going on. We've all breathed the air of West Michigan niceness, but we just wouldn't name it. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't call it as it is. And maybe just by exposing that we don't have to put up that facade anymore, that maybe it will start to create spaces in our churches and neighborhoods and maybe in other places, especially for multicultural churches or those who are looking at churches where they are in transitional neighborhoods or being regenderfied, that they will begin to kind of look at what is the ground level stuff that we really have to do. And maybe that will create new models of really blood-bought, hard-fought racial conciliation that can really stick and can really further the work of this racial work here in the American context.
So now you are, and I'm going to read it because if I get this wrong, I'm going to have to re-record it, and that would be terrible. So you're the director of the Offices of Race Relations and the Offices of Social Justice for the Christian Reformed Church of North America.
That is exactly right.
Okay, so it's not like you're just sucking this out of your thumb. Like, you, like, this is your job.
This is my job.
To understand this exact kind of problem.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's give some examples. Let's talk about multi-ethnic churches for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
In multi-ethnic churches, where do you see that nice ethic playing out? Can you give an example or two?
Sure. You see that being played out in churches that are looking at multi-ethnic growth as really kind of a survival mm-hmm. tactic or survival mechanism. And what happens is that you end up just using people for your own survival. Before I had my current job, I was a pastor of a church for 20 years mm-hmm. that was trying to be this kind of authentic multi-ethnic church. And what happens is that our sociology bumps up against our actual lives. Mm-hmm. And when our sociology bumps up against our actual lives, we find out who we really are. And it comes out in probably not the place you want it to come out.
At this point in the interview, Pastor Reggie gives an example from his former church of a time when sociology bumped up against the actual lives of some of his congregants.
We were trying to combine our youth and children's ministries together. For many years, it was one track in which there was one track for church kids and one track for community kids. And we decided that it would be good to combine them. And then all hell broke loose. And I remember a parent coming in and saying, I don't want my kids hanging out with those community kids. They're better kids than them. They need their own ministry. Unfortunately, most of those kids who were in the community were African American and Hispanic. Most of the ones who were in the church were white. Mm-hmm. And so here this picture just emerges of it was nice for these kids to be here if only it was all on our terms. And what happens is that those young people heard that. And they know when they're being used. And so it was incidents like that just really kind of crystallized for me. They said it was about the theology. And it was not about the theology.
Explain that a little bit. Like, a theology, what did you understand that to mean?
The theology of if we just love people because Jesus would want us to love people where they're at, and that nothing has to really change until we get entered into their lives and find out that people are not the same. They're very different. And that means adjustment mm-hmm. and rethinking. And most insiders say, I'm not doing that. Mm-hmm. That's too much work. That's not convenient for me. And here is how it shows up, usually in children and youth ministries, because that becomes a sticky situation where people are saying, I would prefer to have something that's safe than diverse.
Why do you think kids are the line where people start to fight these battles, perhaps?
I think that people are very protective of their children. And I think that they don't include their children as being part of, that they have to learn discipleship. And what discipleship teaches us is that you're not going to be guarded. The Lord Jesus is not going to put a helmet on your head. He's not going to put knee pads on you or elbow pads on you and say that in order to follow me, I'm going to make it as safe as possible. It's rather the opposite. That our children become part of the army of God. They become a part of actually living life, not by having a bubble of safety, but rather learning discipleship through parents modeling, through a church modeling, the kind of discipleship that doesn't have a weak theology of suffering. And I think that's what really is really missing from a lot of multi-ethnic churches is that we've kind of uncoupled suffering with discipleship. And we believe that vicariously through Jesus, but existentially, where we really live, we are really running away from suffering. We consider suffering is something that you want very little of. And we remove ourselves from suffering people. And so our children become this idea that we can have discipleship and non-suffering and still be okay. And to think that our maturity as a follower of Jesus Christ will go up exponentially, mm-hmm. and it doesn't. What it does is that it retards our discipleship. It stunts our capacity for courage. It minimizes that sin touches us, but it doesn't have to be the last word in our lives. If Jesus would have avoided the cross, we would all be in a bad, bad place. Mm-hmm. But the same thing that Jesus did, he is also expecting us to do, as well as our children, that they will all enter the good fight of discipleship, no matter where it is, not running away from it, but actually like a fireman running towards it. It's becoming more and more as churches, especially multi-ethnic churches, research seems to say that most multi-ethnic churches are in the city. There are a few out in the suburbs, but what happens is that a lot of white people like to come to multi-ethnic churches because it has a good feel to it, a good vibe to it. It feels right. And usually there is there's a point. It's like a tipping point that happens. And the tipping point happens when white people get involved in people of color's lives, and then they're invited into not just their church life, but their actual life, the real life, which very often has extensions to that. And we see this value put on order.
That these are cultural values.
These are cultural values which have judgments about who you are.
At this point in the conversation, Pastor Reggie gives a hypothetical example of what he's talking about, where value judgments are being made by white people about people of color. In this example, a white person is making suggestions to a person of color about how better to order a home.
Can you order right relationships where everything is in their proper place? Or
are you air quoting proper place? Because somebody's got to decide what the proper place is.
Well, you know who's going to decide who the proper place is. And they know what that proper place is, and they know what it's going to feel like, and they know what it's going to look like. And then what happens is that we try to take over people's lives. And if we can bring order to their lives, then that's exactly what Jesus would do. And because we want to fix people. And there is nothing worse that you can do is trying to fix people, because they didn't ask you to fix them. They just ask you to do life with them. And there becomes this this anxiety that I think a lot of white people have of this kind of messiah complex. And when they can't save you, they don't know what to do.
See, I think it's interesting. I just think sometimes we as white people need saving from ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example. I had someone in my extended family who was struggling with drug use. I felt a tremendous amount of shame that, like, this was in my family, that I didn't know it was happening. Now I found out and it's too late, not knowing, because there's a lot of secret keeping.
Mm-hmm.
And to find out, secret keeping isn't something that everybody does.
Right.
So some of my black friends were like, oh, like, you didn't know. And they're like, I think everybody's family's got stuff like that.
Right.
And to me, like, the idea that, like, we can talk about things and put our cards on the table, and they don't have to all be worked out and resolved.
Right.
That someone can just sit with you in your pain without having to have an answer. Like, I found that to be incredibly healing, and as subsequent things would happen in my own life and in my family's life, to realize that, like, I can just express it, and I'm not being told to shush, or, like, you shouldn't say that out loud. You can only pray about things that aren't your fault.
Right.
You know, that kind of... I found that incredibly healing, and I'm like, that's sort of like getting healed from a little bit of the whiteness that's dysfunctional.
I think one of the things that, and I've seen this, you know, pastoring a church, being healed from appearances, and that appearances are not fatal. And one of the second things is that there's no saying that if you want to know who I am, get in the coffin with me. And that simply means that you have to, they're asking you to get in into the places in which they can't understand, which is death. Sit with me. Job's friends were at their best when they shut their mouths and didn't say a dang word. It was not until they opened their mouths they got into trouble. How do we create spaces in which we get into the coffin with people and begin to not try to fix, to not try to solve, but to actually just take Woody Allen's advice, just show up. And so when we show up, all we do is just pay attention and we be present. And we watch something amazing happens. What happens is that people begin to open up. People begin to share. People begin to display their own secrets. And to find out that those secrets don't have as much power as they thought they did, they actually become part of this redemptive process in which God is redeeming all of our stories and grafting them into the larger story of Jesus. And we can only see ourselves as an episode of the story. We are never the main story. And unfortunately for white people, they have swallowed this lie that they have to be the main story. And you don't have to be. There is so much of a burden to have to be perfect, to have all the power, to have to make it, to have it all together, when the gospel is really asking you to do the exact opposite. Embrace your weakness. Be okay with being the little story that you can actually learn from others, and that expands your capacity for a larger story. And you only get stories if they are listened out of people. And so when we think of multi-ethnic churches, multiracial churches, you know, one of the first things that they do is, and I've heard this story, is that a white church wanted to join a person of color church, a Somalian church. And when they were trying to join this church, they wanted to put them all together. They wanted to order them, put the structure together.
We're talking about they, meaning the white, people wanted to organize.
They wanted to organize.
It wasn't
them.
The Somali people.
It wasn't the Somali people. They didn't want to order the white people.
Maybe they did.
And, well, they wouldn't do it. The Somali people just wouldn't do it. So the white people finally wouldn't ask them, well, we're trying to do this for you. We're trying to organize you. And then one of the Somali leaders said, you haven't eaten with us.
Yeah.
It never occurred to them. something so basic and relational makes the biggest difference. Yeah. They had to eat with them. That was important to them. Not being organized, not getting the structure. Break bread with me. This is how we do life together. And I think they may be on to something. You can only do life together if you are in close proximity with one another. One of the reasons why my wife and I, that we live where we live, and we've lived there for 22 years, and we're in a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood, and it's because I want their problems to be my problems. So when my house got shot up in a decade ago, and my church came to me and they said, Pastor, we need to move you out. You need to have a safer place. And I can remember my in-laws said, well, I don't want my granddaughters to get shot. They need to come to out here to Ottawa County. And my wife and I had to make a decision. We could have very easily said, you know what? Safety is more important than discipleship. Safety is more important than community. But if I would have left, then my neighbor next door, who's from Nicaragua and El Salvador, said, Pastor, if you leave, we leave it. My neighbor across the street from Mexico, undocumented citizens, they said, if you leave, we leave. Two white couples who had just moved into our block right after the incident said, if you leave, we leave. What would have sent a message if we would have left? We would have sent the message. Safety is more important than community. And we said, we're going to buck that trend. We are going to stay. And we've been there ever since. And now my neighbor next door took down our old fence and built an entirely new fence because we've been neighbors for almost 20 years. We do life together. Jesus changed us because he came in close proximity to the very people who wanted to choose safety and power as a better alternative than the Father.
I'm wondering if we could close this interview, if you would pray for people who are struggling with an addiction to niceness as opposed to deep relationship.
I can. Let's pray. Dear Jesus, you've called us to so much more. You want us to move beyond just niceness. You want us to move beyond just all the surface kind of life. You're asking us to get deeper. You're asking us to get honest. Lord, I pray for those who may hear this podcast that you would begin to nudge them to those difficult conversations, those hard conversations. Maybe it's a multi-ethnic church or a white church that's thinking about maybe beginning a relationship. Father, I pray that you would help them to approach it from doing life together and that they would listen more than they talk and that they would pray with those various people and that they would get to know them personally. Lord, thank you that you are always looking for ways to expand our story and that the story didn't begin with us. It began with you who stooped down all the way from heaven and lived and moved into our neighborhood. Lord, may we move into the neighborhood in order that we may build authentic and real communities that follows you and emulates your church. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
You've been listening to the Antioch Worship Leadership Podcast.
You have been listening to the Antioch Worship Leadership Podcast. The opinions expressed on the Antioch Worship Leadership Podcast are not the official views of Madison Church, its leadership, or the denomination of the Christian Reformed Church. Madison Church is a member of the Christian Reformed Church and adheres to its doctrinal standards. The purpose of this podcast is to provide recorded examples of the kinds of conversations which we believe churches need to have in an increasingly diverse world. These kinds of conversations pave the way for a multi-ethnic congregation to design worship services with unity and justice, and truly worship God diversely together. Thanks for listening. Bye!
Do you have a comment, correction, or just want to say hi? You can do so. You can find us on Facebook or send us an email at antiochpod@gmail.com. Thanks. The sound bed for this podcast was recorded by Ken Reynolds of the Madison Square Church Fellowship Choir. Antioch Podcast listeners, we're now on the web at www.antiochpodcast.org. And if you like what you hear, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. A positive rating helps other people discover us when searching for new podcasts. Thanks.